Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 2 minutes after 9 a.m., March 10th, 2023. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Co-Chair Senator Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel. Senator Merrick will not be attending today. She's excused from the committee. This morning, we're going to hear a presentation dealing with power cost equalization, which affects many, many people around the state from one end to the other. And we're going to talk about the endowment, maybe the investment policy, and cash flows, asset allocation, market performance, anything else the committee members want to throw down the table. With that, we'd like to have Zach Hanna, Chief Investment Officer, Department of Revenue, come forward. I see you've got some assistance in the back if need be. We'll let you have lifelines when you need them. And with that, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and take us through the presentation, please.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for taking the time today. For the record, I am Zach Hanna. I'm the Chief Investment Officer for the Treasury Division in the Department of Revenue. This is my 20th year as an investment officer for the Treasury Division and my third year as CIO. So as folks know, I've put together some materials that should address questions that the committee posed on the Power Cost Equalization Fund. In the interest of time, I may skip or cover some of these in brief, but feel free to speed me up or slow me down as the committee would like. So page 3 has some background on the Power Cost Equalization Program. This committee is well aware the program helps to reduce high energy costs for close to 80,000 Alaskans and approximately 200 communities throughout the state. The Alaska Energy Authority administers the program, and the Department of Revenue manages the investments. Page 4 has the PC cash flows over the past 10 plus years. You can see earnings, withdrawals, balances, and some simple earnings and spending rates along with totals and some averages in that large table. Obviously, the focus right now is a difficult 2022, but as you can see in the totals over the long term, even including 2022, the earnings have been roughly 6.8%, well in excess of the 4.3% spending rate. In fact, 2022 was notable from a downside perspective, but the prior 9 years were likely even more uncommon since they were strongly positive with an average return over 9%. But clearly, 2022 was a challenging year. The decrease in fund balance from the end of FY21, so a year and a half, was $191 million. And in a point I will touch on later, this decrease was through a combination of both investment losses and fund withdrawals. Overall, $55 million came from withdrawals and $137 million from investment losses. Turn to page 6. The next several pages cover an overview of the state investment policy and asset allocation process that we use for the roughly $8 billion in funds under the fiduciary control of the Commissioner of Revenue. We work to design an investment program for each fund that balances investment objectives, risk tolerance, and other attributes. Starting in December of 2020, we transitioned to a more transparent and independent process for doing this. We now cover state investments each quarter with the commissioner and an independent investment advisory committee. Everything, including investment policy and asset allocation, is subject to scrutiny and discussion, and both the meeting materials and a summary are publicly available on our website. So we're now entering kind of our third year of that process. It's a strong process that mirrors in some respects what we do for the retirement systems.
So if we could just stop there on that.
Sure.
Slide, you might want to, if you could, explain what these charts are.
Certainly. And we will go into some of this in more depth later. So the chart on the top right is a scattergram of compound 10-year returns on the left and standard deviation, kind of the shorthand for risk and investments on the bottom axis. And this is using Callan's current capital market assumptions that they put forward for 2023. And it's the range of returns that you see from cash at the far left through 100% bond portfolios, and then in 10% stock increments up through 100% stock portfolios. And we'll be covering this in some depth a couple slides forward, but that's the top chart. And the bottom chart is just a look at the range of risk tolerances that we employ for various state funds. So it ranges from the lowest level of risk, kind of cash-only funds, short-term funds, and the CBRF at this point, up through our highest risk profile that we'll be covering for PCE today. That also includes the funds below PCE on that table.
And then if you could help me a little bit, or the committee a little bit, we got the PCE fund, the endowment underline there with the highest to the lowest. And then right below that is the public school trust fund. And then the higher education fund. Can you kind of touch on those two things and why they're possibly classified as in a higher risk level in PCE? And what's the marginal difference there?
Sure. So all of the funds at the bottom are at the same high risk profile. And so it's not to denote that any of those below PCE are at a higher risk than PCE is. All of those are at the same risk profile as PCE at this point. And so we'll go into that, and I can kind of explain why we view that as kind of the highest acceptable risk profile that we recommend for state funds. But for a variety of reasons, all of those funds have a time horizon that allows them to take on a certain amount of risk and have an appetite for return, an ability to accept some amount of volatility that allows us to employ that risk profile. But PCE has the exact same risk profile at this point in time as does public schools and the higher ed fund and the other funds below that.
And are they commingled and managed?
So they're commingled at the underlying investment level. And so when they invest in domestic stocks, for instance, or fixed income, they're commingled at that underlying building block level, but they aren't commingled at the overall asset class level. So they could have different asset allocations. They don't at this point in time.
Okay. And then, so everything from PCE endowment in your chart on down, or there's a commingled group? Or is it, there's the commingled group dealing, you know, mixed in with the CBR fund?
So all of these funds on that table share an underlying common group of investment building blocks by asset class. All of the funds above PCE, with the exception of Jafonzi and International Airport Fund, have differing asset allocations. And so they use a different proportion of those underlying building blocks. But starting with PCE and working your way down the table, so PCE all the way through the education endowment, they have the same kind of highest risk profile asset allocation.
Okay. So just I wasn't clear on that first time you answered the question, that it would include the entire group with just different allocations amongst the group. Is that correct?
Correct. They use the same underlying building blocks. They all potentially could have different asset allocations, and most of them do.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hanna, of these funds, we all know that the administration deemed the PCE fund sweepable. Eventually, it was not determined so by the courts. What other funds listed here were deemed sweepable?
So of these funds, higher ed was deemed sweepable. I think that was the only other fund of the highest risk funds, but that isn't something that I cover specifically, but I believe that's the only other fund in the highest risk category.
And when they were deemed sweepable, what action did your office do as a result of that determination? Regarding the investments.
So, I have a slide that covers that specifically.
All right. We'll wait for that slide. Any other questions on this page? Okay, next page, please.
Okay, I'm going to, interest of time, I'm going to skip over page 7 and move to page 8. So this committee is aware, Cowan is investment consultant.
Let's back up and hit on page 7. So not only does the committee members need to follow the presentation, but the public also. So I'm afraid if we jump around too much, that might not be as clear as it, as the work that went into this presentation would represent.
Okay, I'm happy to go through the slide. Cowan is the investment consultant for both the ARM board and APSC, as folks are aware. For consistency, Department of Revenue also uses their capital market assumptions for independence and consistency with other capital market assumptions that the state is using. And I'll go into this in some detail. When I'm talking about capital market assumptions, I'm talking about forward expectations for risk and return and correlations of various asset classes. The next slide will cover that in probably more detail than folks want to go into. Charts on the right illustrate just a couple of aspects of that have influenced investing really over the past 30 years. And you may have seen versions of this from Cowan. It's, you know, the pie chart of the top right is a Cowan chart that basically illustrates to achieve a 7% nominal or total return over time, way back when in 1993, you could have a fairly simple portfolio composed just of largely fixed income. And over time, as interest rates have fallen, fixed income has provided less and less return to portfolios. And you've needed to supplement that with increasing levels of risk in the form of equities and in the form of other asset classes. And so as you move across from 2008 to 2022, you can see increasingly risky portfolios as measured by that risk number. Again, that's a standard deviation. You're going up to almost 17% risk in 2022. And then you see something curious happen in 2023 because obviously we've now lived through a once in a hopefully lifetime increase in interest rates that had very negative negative impact on returns, which we'll cover, but has a positive impact on forward expectations because now the fixed income portion of your portfolio is expected to provide significantly higher returns. And again, to achieve this nominal 7% return, you are now required to hold less kind of equity risk assets. Ultimately, if that's your goal. And so the chart at the bottom, you can see it's a repeat of a chart that we covered a moment ago that, again, has this kind of forward risk and return, and it has the 2022 and the 2023 line. And you can see that 2023 is a significant step up because fixed income, the expectation for fixed income returns is so much higher. And we have gone through, obviously, an equity market correction as well. And so the forward expectation for equities is also, modestly higher.
So to put it in simpler language, as interest rates go up, bonds go down, and you're telling us that we came off of a historically low interest rate environment. So bonds came under significant downward pressure at the same time the equity market, the stock market sold off. So both asset classes went out with the tide together.
They did.
Okay.
Moving forward to page 8. So page 8 has these capital market assumptions in greater detail. So each year we go through a process in Department of Revenue to select asset classes for inclusion in state portfolios. So in the table, the asset classes we are currently using are those that are in bold and italics, and they include a diverse set of liquid public market investments. And I'll be using the term liquid probably a number of times throughout this presentation to refer to securities that are traded daily and marked to market. And that certainly is a characteristic of our state portfolios. They're composed strictly of liquid securities for a variety of reasons. And so you can kind of see at the bottom of the table, again, this is a Cowan set of capital market assumptions and includes 10-year forward expected returns, the risk or standard deviation, correlations to equities, and then some other statistics. Those at the bottom that we don't invest in are those that aren't publicly traded, like private equity and private real estate. And so it's something that The state could not invest in most of those asset classes until late 2020, when the SEC finally changed their definition of accredited investor to include direct state funds. So for the longest time, retirement funds were considered an accredited investor, and the permanent fund had, had a letter ruling from the SEC allowing them to invest in alternative assets. But holdings that were direct holdings of state governments could not invest in unregistered securities like these private market investments. And so that is no longer the case. So really starting in 2021, it is in fact possible for the state to directly invest in alternative investment in these portfolios. But we still don't recommend that. So there's ultimately a liquidity mismatch in our view in terms of the illiquidity that you take on with these alternative investments and compared with the annual budgetary and policy changes that can take place with the legislature and kind of with the administration. And so we don't recommend these investments, for these state portfolios because it can take significant amount of time. It can take, several years, probably 5+ years for asset classes like private equity, to liquidate should someone want to take that course of action. And so there was some interest from the committee to compare the PC asset allocation to the ARM board and to APFC. There is a quick comparison in the appendix. Happy to cover that at the end if the committee would like. But the short story is the biggest difference is these alternative investments, which alter both liquidity profile and the character of the returns.
So the ARM board, what is that?
ARM board is the Alaska Retirement Management Board. And so those are the pension assets, and the Department of Revenue manages those on behalf of the state as well.
So you're comparing the allocation here relative to the allocation of the retirement funds, is that correct?
So the exhibit in the back has a comparison of PCE to the ARM board's asset allocation, which does include significant exposure to alternative investments and to APFC's allocation, which also has significant exposure to alternative investments.
Okay, so we'll try to stay away from acronyms for those that aren't as familiar to follow along with the conversation.
So Alaska Retirement Management Board pension assets, Alaska Permanent Fund is obviously the permanent fund. That's what APFC.
Okay, we'll go on to page 9.
Okay, page 9 has the PC investment policy as adopted for this fiscal year. So this is part of usually an annual process that we go through. The portfolio is designed to target the statutory goals of prudently maximizing total return and considering future purchasing power. I'll touch on this in greater detail when we go through the prospective FY24 asset allocation shortly. But I did want to note that the degree of asset smoothing impact spending volatility was something that was touched on by the committee earlier that I do intend to address in the presentation later. And last, there's always a natural tension between current spending and the preservation of purchasing power. Again, we'll touch on that here in a moment.
Okay.
Okay, so a couple slides on performance, and really the focus is on last year, 2022. And so as we all know, it was a very challenging year. The chart on the right is something we refer to as a periodic table of returns. So for each time period, it rank orders asset class returns from highest to lowest. So looking at 2022, you can see that only cash had a positive return of 1.5% due to the impact of rising inflation and interest rates. Broad market U.S. equities were down 19.2% towards the bottom of the column. And the most unique aspect of last year was that bonds were down materially at negative 13%, since interest rates increased dramatically off such a low base. So unless you own material cash last year or alternative investments that weren't fully marked to market, your returns were likely challenging. You can see there's a little inset table on the left. Basically, any simple combination of stock and bonds last year performed poorly. And the last comment on this on this page is to point out on the far right, I've broken 2022 into two halves. And you can see that the first half of the year was almost universally bad. But the second half of the year, most equities actually had positive performance and outperformed bonds.
So is this your asset mix, little scale here on the left, is that fairly common, or is it to have results like that, or is it happen every decade or every couple decades, do you know offhand, or is this the first time in history? Or
So great question. I think clearly this is certainly probably a once in a lifetime event. I think it's, every time there's significant market drawdowns, I always enjoy all of the investment editors, the time machine, they go back. It's been X years since such and such happened. And I think, folks had to go back, I think, into the 1800s when you had stock and bonds co-perform so poorly. And so obviously a very unique set of circumstances last year, starting, going through the COVID period, such massive stimulus pushing bond yields down basically, or cash yields down effectively to zero, starting at such a low base. And then having to be so reactive to an inflationary environment is really what made for, such a sharp move downward in bonds as they adjust to the new higher yields. One of the nice things about bonds, perhaps as opposed to equities, is that, as your returns are low during that interest rate reset, you're effectively buying kind of forward higher yields. You really aren't losing money necessarily if you hold those bonds, kind of through to maturity. Your ultimate expectation when you entered into the purchase of those bonds will likely still be met, provided you don't have significant defaults, which is a reasonable proviso. You could have defaults and a significant market contraction, whereas equities are much more volatile. And you have much less of a contractual commitment to pay kind of principal and interest like you do for bonds. And so while we certainly saw, a sharp negative performance in bonds last year, the silver lining is that forward expectations have now been reset and are much higher moving forward.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just good morning. What's the highest yielding bonds out there today?
So the yield curve right now. So if you think about, from cash at very kind of, very short term rates up through longer rates, goes up into the 10-year is close to 4% now, the 10-year point of the yield curve. And the front end of the yield curve near cash is close to 5%. And so beyond that, you have riskier bonds that are really a spread off of government bonds that can be several hundred basis points. And basis points are, so if you go from 4% at the 10-year, up to, say, 6%, something like that, that's a 200 basis point move upward, for higher yielding bonds. And for, particularly risky bonds, you can have yields that, that do get into the double digits, but certainly into the high single digits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So in your bond portfolio, you were talking about if you hold it to maturity, you shouldn't worry about the interest rate. It'll all come out in the wash is how I interpreted that. But is your bond portfolio individual bonds or in bond funds? Or how do you handle your bond portfolio?
Yes, our bond portfolio is an individual bonds. And okay. So it's an actively managed bond portfolio. Where we hold individual bonds and look to outperform a bond index that we'll cover a little.
Yeah. But an actively managed portfolio isn't that different from, say, a laddered approach to bond portfolio management where you're going to hold them to maturity?
It is different, and there's certainly a laddered aspect to all of it. You certainly are holding bonds at various levels of maturity. Mm-hmm. The only point I was trying to make is that. That there is still this contractual commitment for repayment on bonds, unlike for equities, that does allow for, even though you've seen a sharp reset in returns for bonds last year, you have effectively bought forward kind of higher yields throughout your portfolio, even though you aren't necessarily holding that entire portfolio all to maturity. To the extent that you are trading that portfolio, you're trading it with the expectation that what you're buying is better than what you're selling.
And what is the turnover rate of your bond portfolio?
I'm sorry?
The turnover rate of the bond portfolio.
I don't have that information with me.
Okay. You can get that back to the committee. Take a look at the last 2-3 years and give us an estimate would be fine. Any other questions on slide 11? Slide 12, please.
Okay, so slide 12 has actual PC performance in some detail. I don't intend to cover this in excruciating detail since this has been covered, I think, in 2 prior meetings and through a fair amount of Q&A. Certainly happy to answer any questions. I point out that the performance for the one-year period and for most periods has been modestly ahead of its benchmark, although 2022 clearly a poor year from a total return perspective overall, and that most of the outperformance comes from fixed income asset classes, which again are the most actively managed in the state portfolios as opposed to the equity asset classes that are largely invested in stock market benchmarks, stock market indices, excuse me.
Okay. Do we have any questions on this slide? Okay. Slide number 13.
Okay, so 13, I think, is responsive to Senator Hoffman's earlier question. And so I did want to address the request that the committee made to compare the performance of the portfolio with prior asset allocations. And so there have been a number of changes over the years. There's been legislative changes that underlie kind of some of these asset allocation changes. But in particular, there have been 3 asset allocation moves over the past few years. And so you can see in the included table, I compare the actual returns of PCE with the returns of these 3 portfolios as if there had been no additional asset allocation changes. So I just point out a few things. The first is that the change last year to prudent investor resulted in better, not worse returns than having not made that change, since it increased equity risk and equities outperformed in the second half of last year. The second comment is that the original portfolio that targeted a roughly 7% return had the worst performance in 2022 since it was the highest risk, but had the best performance over the full 3-year period. And my last comment is that I think the current standard makes good sense, and forward asset allocations are subject to a very transparent and independent review. And I guess specific to Senator Hoffman's question, so the largest change that you can see in this table is that 5% target return. I've titled it July 2020. And so there was a de-risking that occurred at that point in time. And so there was a legislative change, I think it was in 2017, that went from kind of a statutory target of a 7% nominal return for PCE. It moved that down to a minimum return of 4% at that time. And so we continued to invest towards six to 7% return for a number of years after that legislative change was made. But then in July of 2020, and so kind of think back, what was going on in the world at that point, we were middle of COVID, and the fiscal circumstances of the state and the market itself very, very uncertain. And that's where I think, a lot of this concern about sweeping, in particular for PCE, came into kind of the thought process. And ultimately, the time horizon for any fund that we manage, but for across these funds, the time horizon really is the biggest determinant of the amount of risk that a fund can bear. And so there was a view at that point in time that there was a risk that the time horizon for PCE was shortening. The decision was made to take the risk down a bit and focus on a 5% return that again was targeting kind of the spending rate, didn't reduce it down to the 4% that would have been permissible by statute, but targeted that 5% return. So that's the biggest change that was made.
So we got some questions, but just for clarity, when you de-risk it, did you, are you talking about building the cash position or building short-term bond position, or what did you actually do?
So it's in that stock bond column, it was largely a shift from equities into bonds. There wasn't really, there was a small cash allocation, but the cash allocation didn't change.
And the time frame of those bonds, were they long-term, short-term, medium-term?
They were broad market bonds that have a maturity or, we think of it generally in terms of duration of kind of a duration of 5 to 6, but maturity, probably roughly equivalent to that. 5, 6, 7 year bond is a broad market bonds, not short-term bonds.
And what is duration?
Duration is the amount of interest rate sensitivity in a bond portfolio. And so technically, if you have a bond portfolio that has a duration of, let's say, 6, which is about where bond portfolios are right now, if you have a 100 basis point or kind of a 1% change in interest rates, all things equal, you would expect that bond portfolio to have either an increase, if you have interest rates going down, an increase in value by 6% or a decrease in value by 6%. If the interest rates go up.
Or a one-time shift, right?
Yes, one-time shift across the curve. A lot of caveats to that, but that's the way duration is thought of.
Okay. Senator Hoffman and Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the administration deemed the power cost equalization sweepable, when did the Department of Revenue, what did the Department of Revenue do? Where did they move those funds? How long did they move them? Did they go into the CBR? Because most of the funds that were swept were very, very small in comparison to $1 billion.
So what
were the actions? Obviously you looked at those other charts and they were distributed through different asset allocations. Let's see the trail of tears.
The chair, Senator Hoffman. So I think this table is accurate in terms of the trail. I think the concern was that PCE would be swept and would go into the CBR. My understanding, and it wasn't swept. And so it was de-risked because there was a concern that it would be swept. And if it was left in high risk, that had the impact of potentially shortening the investment horizon, but it was not swept into the CBR.
So let me help.
Let me ask.
Okay, follow up.
If you, your understanding, I have a different understanding. I was informed that the funds were taking out of those asset allocations and getting ready to be swept. So is it your understanding or your actual knowledge that that was the case?
It is my knowledge, which, should be correct, that this is what transpired.
The funds were never taken out of those asset allocations.
Correct, for PCE.
So they were just reallocated into a shorter time horizon into bonds. And then what was the impetus for the department to draw the conclusion that you should look at the asset allocation of PCE and prepare it for liquidation?
So I wasn't at the table for some of those discussions, and so I don't know the specific impetus, but my understanding was that the view that these funds might potentially be swept, that there was a view that the risk of that had increased materially enough to decrease the risk of these funds.
But how does that help me with the mechanics? Is that from the legislature or from a chain of command in the revenue department? What was the information that led you to draw that conclusion?
Yeah, and again, I wasn't the CIO at that time. My understanding, this, all all of these decisions are decisions that are, in discussion with the department. And it was some combination of, information that was provided by, kind of that collective group that led to this decision.
Okay, but is it the collective group of the Senate Finance Committee or the collective group of the
Department of Revenue?
Ultimately,
so the Department of Revenue annually goes through this process. This is part of the annual ask allocation process that the department went through back in 2020. And so the time horizon of every fund, is considered when we go through that process. And for PCE, the view was that there was a risk that, this is my understanding in terms of going through some of the documentation, the view was that there was a risk that it might have a shortened time horizon. But I would note it wasn't as if this was reduced to a cash allocation. It still had, a fair amount of investment risk. It was targeted at a 5% return rather than I'd have to look back at what the return was prior, but somewhere in the 6-7% range is where it was before. And so I don't know that I'd call it a modesty risking, but it was not as if this were totally de-risked by any measure.
Right. So if you can help the committee on the dates that it was de-risked and then the dates that it was actually increased, I would imagine it would be measured in days or weeks or months or whatever, the actual time frame that those two allocation alterations were transpired.
Yeah. So looking back at these, typically when we make annual asset allocation changes, the shift in risk happens fairly quickly within the first several weeks, of the new fiscal year. And I believe that's what took place at this point in time as well.
Okay, if you can get back to the committee on the weeks, both the allocation de-risking took place and then when it was unwound.
Okay.
Okay. And measured in weeks would be preferred versus annually. Okay. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've answered some of my questions. The only thing I would like to add is I just want to know who was in the room when it happened. Some of the decisions that were made from the 7-5%, just how that was made and who made those decisions. Was it just your predecessor? Was it the commissioner? Was it just one of the investment officers you have? Just who was in the room?
If you can get back to the committee on that, I guess a little more specific on that structure, and quite frankly, that's even a broader question on how the department deals with its asset allocation decisions, and because the commissioner has, as we're all aware, very extensive powers in the Department of Revenue and authority, and he or she may have counsel from other folks, or they may not. So if you could help us with that, go ahead. And then we'll go to Senator Bishop. No, go ahead, Matt.
Okay. So I certainly would be happy to look into that, but I think it's at least worth, making the comment that, since I've been CIO, we now do have, a very transparent process that does have independent review of all of these decisions. And it's a quarterly process. It's not an annual process. And so every change in asset allocation is subject to a lot of scrutiny by independent experts. And again, it's very transparent. This stuff is all well published. Certainly on a go-forward basis and the process that we've used, the past kind of 2.5 years is subject to, a high level of scrutiny.
And with that, we've encouraged the commissioners, pretty much every commissioner that's come before us for years, to have a process. And there's no expectation that the decisions they're going to make are going to be correct, because hindsight's 20/20 in this game, not looking forward. But we encourage them to have a process that they could fall back on and show why they made the decision, because we have had an incident in the past where the results cost the state over $1 billion. And those, at that time, there was a request from the commissioner for a signed letter by both the chairmen of the Finance Committee, Senator Hoffman, Senator Stedman, and we refused to sign the letter. And promptly, $1 billion disappeared, and it didn't sit very well with the Finance Committee, I'll assure you that. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. My question might be off base, so if it is disregarded, but to your comments a few minutes ago about the timeline on when the funds were theoretically maybe going to be swept and maybe changes in asset allocations, et cetera, along your questioning, could you provide us with the losses or gains that would occur when that transition was happening, please?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. So this table attempts to kind of actually answer that question. And so you can see that the actual PCE portfolio is the bold portfolio, mm-hmm. and those are its returns over 1, 2, and 3 year periods. And you can compare as you move upward in the table to if, you know, had you stopped at any point in time and not made any further decisions, those are the returns that you would have had. And so, you know, as you move up to the prior portfolio, you know, the PCE fund generally outperformed that fund. So that was the move to the prudent investor. And as you go back, you know, one more in time, it outperformed that fund as well. But that original 7% fund had worse performance over the 1 year period, but had better performance over the 3 year period. Because again, if you kind of think back over it's really unique period of time, the COVID period, you know, extremely high risk as we went through, you know, kind of the pandemic. But ultimately, you know, so much stimulus was pumped into the system and, you know, the outcome of the pandemic was kind of a more reasonable outcome in stock markets and capital markets generally had very, very strong performance. So if you had higher risk during that period for the longer term, you tended to outperform. And so in terms of timing, I guess, just to set expectations when I get you data in terms of how quickly these things transpired, when I say July of 2020 and 21 and 22, those are the start of each fiscal year. That's when a new asset allocation goes into effect. And generally speaking, that new asset allocation is put into place fairly quickly. And so it's probably a matter of days, you know, could be as much as a week or two. You know, there might be special circumstances at various points in time, but generally that's what takes place is that when I say July of 2020, that really is the very start of July of 2020. That's when that new asset allocation was put into effect and we traded into that new asset allocation.
Okay, Senator Olson, you still have a question? And then Senator Wilson, do you have a follow-up?
I'll get with you offline to try to track where I'm trying to answer the question, ask the question.
I think it might help him when he gets back with a more precise point of the asset allocation change dealing with the liquidation decision versus the general targeted issue here. Senator Olson and then Senator Wilson.
Mr. Hanna, I obviously these were tumultuous times when the maneuver was going on to try and liquidate that power cost equalization funds because we certainly got a lot of phone calls in my office about what was going on. But I think the basic question has to do with what Senator Bishop asked about. What, as you go through these machinations of getting ready to liquidate a fund like that of that magnitude, how much money was either lost or gained? What was the net outcome to the fund a year or two after the liquidation prep had been going on? Do you have any idea?
So through the chair, Senator Olson, I can get back to you in terms of, you know, numbers for that. I don't have dollar figures. The returns are on this page.
I understand that, but to be clear,
there wasn't a liquidation that occurred or was occurring. This fund was, you know, again, modest is not quite the right term, but there was a decrease in risk that occurred. But it was not a, you know, it was not a full de-risking by any means. It was a move from a 6.5% expected return down to a 5% return. And so if that had been a move down to the CBR, that would have been a move down to like a 1% return. I mean, just a you know, in terms of like the spectrum of risk, it was a move from here to here, not a move from here to here. Mm-hmm. And so I certainly can provide information on that, but the fund was not liquidated. It was de-risked, again, modestly, because the view was that there was increased risk that the time horizon might decrease.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify my question, you look at what 2022 and the rate of return did with the fund back then, where you got a specific amount, which is plus or minus 10-20%, was $200 million was lost. As you go through the analysis that I was asked, was how much money did the power cost equalization lose essentially during this pattern of de-risking, as you're putting it, de-risking the fund? That's the number that was asked of me, and I didn't have a good answer. That's what I'm looking for. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilson. Okay. Okay, next slide, please.
Okay, so a lot of information on this page, just to kind of take you through the thought process for PCE of how we think about risk and go through the asset allocation process. So this is the prospective FY24 asset allocation. And so again, it's designed to achieve the statutory goals of maximizing total return and future purchasing power. Lots of numbers on the table to digest. But I'm going to try to point out a few important ones to help highlight some of the key asset allocation trade-offs. We take a look at the PC FY24 asset allocation that's in the middle of the chart, so the one kind of in the box. The first set of bold numbers show return statistics for a 10-year forward period. The nominal or total expected return is 6.8%. And so this is what we expect kind of from this point moving forward if this asset allocation remains the same, which is our current expectation. The next bold number down is referred to as the real return, and that's 4.3%. This is the return you can expect after projected 2.5% inflation. So again, people call it a real return. There's nothing fancy about it. It's just the total return of 6.8% reduced for 2.5% inflation. So if the goal was to completely inflation-proof this fund, that real return number would be my first order estimate of how much you could expect to spend on average. So 4.3% would be our forward expectation for how much this fund could expend and expect to be fully inflation proof. So the last number in this section is the amount of inflation proofing that can be expected if PCE spent at 5% instead, which it certainly can by statute. And so you can see for the recommended portfolio, this is 73%. So if you spend at 5%, you can expect that the earnings that remain in the portfolio will cover roughly 3/4 of expected inflation. So let's take a moment and compare this portfolio to some alternatives. This is, again, kind of responsive to requests some folks in the room had. So in the rightmost table, there are 6 simple example portfolios that range from no risk, 100% cash, up through 100% equities. So if we start with a cash-only portfolio, you can see that the expectation is a low nominal return of 2.7%. So that's well below PCE spending needs and also has a real return of only 0.2%. So it's just barely above expected inflation, which is what you should expect from cash over the long term. So there's really no ability to maintain purchasing power, you know, in that kind of ultimately kind of a riskless sort of investment. So as you move to the right, it isn't until you get to about the 60% equity area that returns and inflation projection start looking at least modestly acceptable. And as you get up into the 80 and 100% equity portfolios, you're increasingly less diversified. And our view is that these test the bounds of prudence. So we position the portfolio at the roughly 70% equity level. This should provide for adequate earnings. It does preserve reasonable purchasing power. It has manageable volatility, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And it's prudent. It's a prudent risk posture from an institutional investment perspective. So the last couple of comments are on downside risk. And so all of this comes at a potential cost, since we can't pursue reasonable returns without taking risk. So low levels of risk are unlikely to produce acceptable earnings, and high levels of risk add potential uncertainty and downside losses. So the last section here, the risk section at the bottom of the table, typically the convention is to talk about risk as standard deviation of returns, which many people, myself included, find a bit opaque. Below these standard deviations, I've included some downside statistical risk measures that I find more useful that address estimates of potential loss. And so the first of these is the 10% probable return over 1 year of negative 15.4%. This is the expected loss 10% of the time, or on average 1 in 10 years. And since this is a 10-year forecast, this isn't even really a downside case. This is the return that one might expect in one of the next 10 years for this portfolio, even on its way to achieving its goal. And somewhat coincidentally, this is very close to the loss that we had last year during a 10-year period that ultimately ended up meeting our earnings goals. Last number I'm going to touch on in this table starts to tie in kind of smoothing periods, and that's the 5% downside return over 3-year periods of negative 8.2%. This is a downside case that's worth considering from a planning perspective, since PCE does have a 3-year smoothing period. And as you can see below that, if PCE had a 5-year smoothing period from a statistical perspective, that number would further be reduced to negative 4.8%. And so you can kind of see as you move from a 1-year period to a 3-year period to a 5-year period, think of that kind of in a smoothing sense, you are smoothing out some of the volatility of these funds. And ultimately the loss that you might expect, at least from a statistical perspective, and I'll touch on historical in a moment, gets reduced as you go from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So let me pause there for a moment. That was a lot before I march on and talk about
smoothing. On slide 15. So help us a little bit with the inflation expectation. And remind me again what the inflation expectation is that you're using over the next decade, and then maybe talk a little bit to the committee about what else you're seeing out in the investment world for inflation expectations over the next decade.
So the inflation expectations, so there, we use Cowen's capital market assumptions for a reason. They're independent. They have a robust process in terms of going about doing what they do. It's certainly easy to take a look, across industry and through various market inputs and, come to at least modestly different kind of conclusions. But their expectation for 10-year forward inflation is 2.5%. That is roughly what market inputs are providing now as well. So if you look at break-evens for inflation-protected bonds, it's roughly in that kind of 2.5% range. Clearly, we're going through, a category X sort of hurricane right now with respect to where inflation currently sits and how quickly or if, it comes down. And so we're in this, tug of war between inflation and growth. The Fed is working to control inflation and everyone has different expectations in terms of, just how quickly they'll be successful. And so embedded in that 2.5%, ultimately is some reduction from, current rates of, 7% or so. And so I don't know if that's responsive to your question in full or not.
Close. I mean, we understand that you use Cowen. And we take a look at what the Department of Revenue tells us for oil price projections. And then we benchmark that against other indices around the world and see if it, passes the test, the red face test. And that was basically the fundamental part of the question. And then the issue of the payout rate of this portfolio under these expectations and allocations, are you going to get into that here in a little bit? As far as, are we too high, too low? Should we draw more money out, not draw as much? Are we in the sweet spot?
Yeah.
So from your perspective.
Excuse me. So my perspective on that is, colored by that expected real return. And so, yeah, a 4.3% spending rate for a portfolio like this is where we are most comfortable. Part of it comes down to, and that's why I tried to provide, to bracket it somewhat between, you know, before the spending at that real return level, you would have a forward expectation of complete inflation proofing. Now, the statute doesn't say complete inflation proofing. It says consider, future purchasing power. And so, you know, if you expend beyond 4.3%, you know, your expectation should be that you are cutting into that forward purchasing power in some sense. But that being said, you aren't reducing it to zero. Spending at 5% still allows you to inflation proof, or our forward expectation anyway of inflation proofing is that it would be kind of 3/4 inflation proofed. And so again, you know, if the goal is to completely inflation proof, you know, our kind of first order, you know, recommendation is to expect to spend at about 4.3%, which is where you've expended PCE historically. It's right on that number. It's not, you know, and again, it's just a perfect coincidence that this year's capital market assumptions have come up with a real return that is spot on with what the spending rate for this, you know, for this portfolio and program has been over time. Is that responsive?
Yes. Did we have another question on this slide before we go to the next one? Okay, next slide, please.
Okay, so page 16 is another way to triangulate downside risk. So I gave you a bunch of statistical, you know, sort of forward-looking numbers. It's easy to kind of, dismiss those to some degree. But this chart compares, 3 and 5 year smoothing for a 70-30 bond portfolio similar to PC over the past 40 plus years. And so this is actual stock market data. So you can see the dotted line, that's the rolling annual returns. You know, again, extremely volatile, you know, highs into the 50 plus percent range, lows into the negative 30 plus percent range. And you can see in the red line, that's 3 year smoothing of those annual returns. You can see that it reduces volatility quite considerably. And then the red, the blue line is 3 year smoothing. So again, you get a significant volatility reduction with 3 year smoothing. And you get some, you know, incremental additional volatility reduction moving to 5 year smoothing, kind of as depicted by that red line. So in the inset table, again, trying to compare those statistical measures to what we have looked at kind of historically, you can see that the 3 year periods are very similar. But the historical market has been more volatile over 1 year periods and less volatile over 5 year periods. And so again, you know, I think, you know, I guess from a red taste, red face perspective, you know, those statistical forward measures pencil out fairly well with what the market has looked like historically from a downside perspective. And the last point I'd make is on the shaded region. This is the prior two market drawdowns and recoveries. And so as expected, 3 year smoothing is more reactive both on the way down and then on the way back up as well. And so again, there were some questions that the committee had about 3 versus 5 year smoothing, and I'll get into a little bit more of that in the next couple slides. But this is a good way to kind of think about it as you go through, you know, market turmoil, is that 3 year smoothing will be more reactive. It'll go down more quickly, but it will also come back up more quickly. And 5 year smoothing kind of averages that out further.
Okay. Next slide, please.
Okay, page 17 takes a look at 3 and 5 year smoothing over the recent history of PCE, so with the actual asset levels. And so you can see that over this period, they're both pretty close, but that 3 year would always have been higher due really to a combination of generally rising markets and PCE's spending profile, so kind of a combination of those two. But that they basically converged at the end of the year with 2022's losses. And we do expect that they'll cross over, and I'll touch on that on the next slide. And so the next couple comments tie back to something I started out with, and that's that PCE spending is based on average balances, which are impacted both by investment returns and spending. And as I'll kind of show, almost in equal measure. And so over 3 year periods, we expect the impact of spending at 5% a year to be roughly a 7.5% reduction in that three-year average. And so if you combine that with a three-year downside return estimate that we touched on a couple slides ago of 8.2%, you arrive at a spending reduction overall, kind of a downside spending reduction of 16%, with roughly half of that reduction coming from spending and half coming from losses. And so to try to put some more context on that, if you apply that to the FY24 budget, just to look at what, how could this, you know, sort of a downside scenario impact spending, that budget for PCE is $54.9 million in total. You would get a reduction in this downside scenario with a, you know, a 16% reduction in that three-year average value to $46 million by FY27. And so next slide, we'll take a look at that from a baseline projection standpoint.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so this is our forward base case for PCE. And so while we certainly don't project the path of markets, if we do hit our baseline case of a median return of 6.8%, here are what asset levels and spending could look like over the next 10 years. Obviously, markets don't operate in this sort of a smooth fashion, but it's at least one estimate of what spending could look like with both 3 and 5 year smoothing. So as you can see in the lower chart, 3 year smoothing would bottom out in this case at 48 million. It's a little bit better than that kind of slightly more downside case that I covered. So that's a roughly 13% reduction from the peak. And it's also several million dollars less than we would expect if you had 5 year smoothing. So you can see 5 year smoothing is a little bit higher for that period of time. And that's why we would generally recommend 5 year smoothing for a fund like PCE. For potential environments like the one we're in, where asset values might decline, since it better cushions the blow, and as you can see, provides for more forward spending visibility as you move forward, because it's just simply slower moving. More of it is known in terms of past asset values, and so you have just less volatility, and the volatility is further out in the future. And so 5 year smoothing is also likely the most common volatility reduction measure used by endowments. And so it's also often used in conjunction with some form of spending control, which, you know, Chair Stedman, you touched on. Those are really when an endowment kind of thinks about these things. Often there is some form of volatility reduction, usually through smoothing or some other measures. But there also is generally a thought to some form of spending control at some level, if, you know, if it appears that that's necessary. I'll pause there.
So to return back to the historic highs of the PCE, it looks like we're looking out, if our projections are correct, about a decade. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then to shorten that time horizon would most likely take an equity infusion or a more risky portfolio.
So, or a market correction beyond these baseline estimates. And so again, this is a baseline kind of smooth projection forward. You know, obviously, you know, markets historically have, you know, it's, you know, have, you know, you can potentially have a quicker rebound. It's certainly not our base case assumption. But yes, to the extent that, and something we didn't really touch on with respect to spending, you know, if you're trying to solve for a certain amount of spending, you know, the math is, you know, relatively easy. You know, at that 5% level, you're really looking at having an asset base that is, you know, 20 times the amount of spending that you would prefer. And at that 4.3% real return level, you're on the order of probably 23 times. You need a, you know, an asset base 23 times the amount of annual spending that you would like to come out of the program.
Okay, next slide, please.
Okay, well, good news for everybody is the next slide is the last slide. So this is just a set of observations that I've already touched on. I'm not going to belabor these things. These are conclusions I've mentioned a couple of times. Certainly appreciate the committee's time. Happy to answer questions. Again, there is a comparison of PCE to both the ARM board and to the permanent fund portfolios that I'm happy to cover. If folks have time and want to spend some time looking at that.
Yes, I think that'd be a good idea. We do have another 15 minutes or so. Senator Wilson.
I can wait to the end if that's if we're going to cover additional. Okay.
Any questions, Senator Wilson?
No, I think this is the end.
You want to not go any further?
No. I'm not. You've written it, and I think this is the end. This is the last one.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if he's going to cover more slides, I can wait till after he finishes.
Right, we have two more slides. If okay. We can walk through these.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Slide so I'm going to turn to page 23, which is the very last slide in the packet.
22, if you want to touch on 22. Since I took the time to make it, you might as well show it to the public.
So 22 is a bit of a response to some questions from the committee, and I think specifically Chair Steadman, in terms of thinking about what are the statutory investment powers and duties that the Commissioner of Revenue has with respect to PCE, and I think most specifically, thinking about prudent investor versus prudent person. I think there were some questions about that, and so I guess I can touch on this briefly. The current standard is prudent investor, and I guess I'll kind of start there. That is the care in which the fiduciary of these funds needs to treat them is the care that a prudent investor would treat kind of like funds, kind of in like circumstances, as if they were their own. And that builds on a body of work that started way back when, kind of in the 1800s, the prudent person standard that was in place for a very long period of time. That was the same in a lot of respects, but it was respect to a prudent person, kind of ordinary intelligence and training in terms of how they would treat their own assets. And it really brings it, it adds a layer of what I would think of as modern portfolio theory to the prudent investor standard, and allows you to think about the portfolio in the whole. And requires a certain amount of diversification. And so with the prior, kind of prudent person standard, every investment was judged independently in terms of whether it was or was not too risky. And so some things that independently might be viewed as speculative or particularly risky under the prudent person standard wouldn't be acceptable. But under the prudent investor standard, provided that those are accretive to the portfolio in the whole, they are permissible. And so, we've talked a lot about alternative investments. That's the largest part. That's been the biggest increase in portfolios as you've shifted from prudent person to prudent investor, because, most of those investments that, might be considered individually, particularly high risk, are viewed to be additive when you consider the overall risk of the portfolio.
So are you recommending we change our prudent man role here on our coffee cups to the prudent investor role?
I would never quarrel with a prudent man.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have currently the prudent investor rule for the fund. How does that translate to the page that you had on page 6 where it's the highest risk tolerance?
So through the chair, Senator Hoffman, really great question. And so the way that would translate is, so a prudent investor looking at the set of circumstances that the department looks at with respect to these funds, it's our view that a prudent investor would reach largely the same conclusions given the same set of facts for these funds. And so when I talked about PC specifically, if you combine, goals of, maximizing returns, and, I'll call it in just a shorthand kind of, some semblance of inflation proofing, of these funds, and the need to support, a reasonably high level of expenditure, it's our belief that a prudent investor would come to the same conclusion, that the department does in terms of adopting, kind of the same relative kind of risk profile. So I hope that's responsive to your question.
Okay. I want to touch on, the center paragraph. I think you've covered the lower paragraph and the beginning paragraph.
Okay. Well, the second paragraph I think it's almost a verbatim recital of AS 3710-071. These are the investment powers and duties that the Commissioner of Revenue has with respect to the funds that are under the fiduciary control. And so it is it touches on elements of that I kind of referenced in talking about prudent investors. So some of these are frankly, these are almost a bit of a definition or aspects of how you define prudent investor. And so you have, you know, safeguarding of assets. You have delegation. That's an important part of prudent investment. You have diversification. You have the use of prudent experts like consultants and advisors. And ultimately, you have, you know, an actual reference to the prudent investor rule with a really important, I think, additional clarification that is in state statutes. And that's to exercise that prudent investor in the sole financial best interest of the beneficiaries. And so that comes into a play in terms of quite a bit of what we do for the state, in particular with respect to the pension systems.
So who's the beneficiaries of PCE?
So the beneficiaries of PCE are many residents of the state.
Okay. We'll go on to the page you've been looking for, page 23.
So save the best or the worst for last. I'm not sure. Excuse me. And so, again, as requested, put together a summary comparison of the PC portfolio with the ARM board and APFC. So the first thing to note is that PC does not have any alternative investments like private equity and private real estate. Those are sizable allocations for the work that I do with the OSC Retirement Management Board and certainly for the work done by the Permanent Fund. And so as you can see in the PC column, as you kind of look across, it has only public equity and fixed income. I've really kind of simplified this. Obviously, public equity and fixed income, as you looked at one of those earlier, capital market, that's composed of 10 or 12 different kind of sub, components of those. But to try to simplify this comparison, PCE is only public market investments in public equities and, again, tradable fixed incomes. And so you can see a large category for alternative investments. PCE has no alternative investments, whereas the ARM board has, and again, the last retirement management board has 36% in alternatives, and the permanent fund has 42% in alternatives. And so you can see, when you get down to the bottom, that PCE, and again, I guess I should note, these are using last year's capital market assumptions because new asset allocations have not been done for all of these groups. And so this is, I think, still a relatively apples to apples comparison. But these are not current numbers. And so you can see last year, the expected return for PC was 5.6% with a 12.4% standard deviation. Those are now likely to change, as we've kind of talked about. And so I did go through a bit of an exercise. You can see as you march forward, I'll just, pick on the ARM board. That has had an expected return of 6.3% with a 13.9% standard deviation. So both higher return and higher risk. So I went through an exercise and used PCE in quotes in that second blue column, increased the risk of PCE to the same risk level of the Alaska Retirement Management Board, at least to make them roughly comparable. So you can kind of understand, what we're talking about in terms of, how ultimately have these alternative investments kind of impacted expectations about forward risk and return. And so you can see kind of when you compare those two, a 6% expected return for PCE, again in quotes, adjusted to a 13.9% risk versus a 6.3% return for the ARM board, again, at kind of equivalent risk levels. And so our view, again, given what I would refer to as policy or kind of governance risk with the state portfolios, again, you can have, either administrative or legislative changes that occur annually with these portfolios. It's difficult to invest in alternative investments that may have liquidity profile that could stretch, well beyond 5 years. It's difficult to have, sizable allocations to those, which is why we don't recommend it. But ultimately, what we're foregoing is that kind of what I would refer to as 30 basis points. So that increase from 6% to 6.3% is the difference that you pick up from a, again, using Talon's capital market expectations that you pick up in having, pretty significant exposure to alternative investments. And so as I look across this table, I think people easily fall into, into viewing a public portfolio as, a portfolio composed only of public market investments as being, less sophisticated or inherently inferior. And I wouldn't view it that way at all. This is a portfolio that is, it's marked to market daily. It's completely liquid. There's like an inherent option value that comes with that liquidity. you know, if you own this portfolio versus owning the Armboard, you know, Armboard portfolio with 36% in alternatives, you know, if market environments change dramatically over the next couple of years and you decide you'd like to do something different with those assets or you need more liquidity for some reason, those alternative investments are largely locked up. So it will take you a matter of years to kind of move forward. And, you know, and the Armboard and APSC have a long time horizon. They have a lot of control over their kind of governance risk. They've made sensible decisions in terms of those investments. So I'm not trying to paint them as bad investments. And obviously, you know, I manage one of those portfolios. So, you know, so I'm a believer in these at the margin. But they also aren't.
Just be a minute. We'll have a brief at ease. Back on the record, go ahead and finish your statement.
Okay, so the last comment I'll make, and then I will be happy to answer any more questions, is that particularly at points of market inflection, like we are kind of going through currently, it makes it very difficult to compare public market portfolios with portfolios that have significant exposure to alternative investments. And that's because as you look through really any sort of a market crisis or a time where you've had a significant drawdown and then, you know, hopefully a rebound, what you'll see is that alternative investments lag public market investments considerably, even though ultimately they are tightly linked. Over time, those valuations will work themselves out. But in the short term, what you find that when you have a market correction down, alternative investments will take quite a long time to be fully marked down. People do their best to mark them as best they can, but they aren't marked to market. And so if you try to compare returns or try to compare outcomes during times of market inflection, that's the most difficult time to compare those returns and to draw conclusions. And what you can expect from a portfolio like PCE moving forward is ultimately, I think, for it to, you know, meet the spending needs of the program. But also, you know, when we go through, a hopeful rebound when that occurs, is you'll find a portfolio that's 100% in public market investments will likely strongly outperform portfolios that have a lot of alternative investments. And so, again, you really get both sides of it. So in a downturn, public-only portfolios will underperform. When you go through that significant upturn, you'll find that outperform strongly. We saw that definitely in spades in the financial crisis, and I expect that we'll see that again.
Okay, Senator Wilson, he's been waiting, and then we'll go to Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if DNR also uses, Department of Revenue also uses Callan and other standard benchmarks that the ARM Board and the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation uses. Why compete with staff or the permanent fund division folks? I've seen, you know, having working with DNR over the past couple of years, it seems like they're always trying to keep up with the Joneses, having staff incentives similar to the PFD or vice versa. It seems that, you know, you made mention on the record that some investment decisions sort of lack transparency over the years, which also leaves one the question, Mr. Chair, how many other transactions were made that way and how many other accounts? If DNR has about 27 investment officers and manages about $8 billion. The Permanent Fund Corporation has about 32 staff and manages about $77 billion. It would seem that we can shift some of those long-term investments to the Permanent Fund Corporation and have fewer investment officers to manage some of those short-term accounts like your SBR, CBR, statutory budgetary reserve, the constitutional budgetary reserves, and your Ponzi accounts, not to mention the potential for the issues that happen with the Department of Revenue, either with staffing changes or the whims of the commissioner or the administration changes every 4 to 8 years. So it just seems that it'd just be more cost effective for the state of Alaska to do that shift.
Is that a question or more of a comment?
Well, both. I mean, I guess I've seen some questionable accounting practices with the Department of Revenue, and just wondering why keep having the investment officers if they have 27 and for $8 billion, and the Permanent Fund Corporation has, you know, almost about the same amount of staff, and they manage, almost 10 times the amount of investments. It just seems that it's more efficient and effective to downsize the Department of Revenue's investment officers.
I don't think it's accounting. I guess I think we need to, we're looking at here the decisions coming down from the very top, coming down to the investment officers. I think that's a question some of us have at the table. At least the impression I got earlier, this was not derived from investment officers. It came from somewhere up the food chain. Is that correct? To reallocate?
The answer to that question is correct. I'd be happy to respond to
the
question as well. As a starting point, so we have 15 investment officers. I don't know exactly the comparison at this point between ourselves and APSC staff-wise, but I expect we're probably, you know, roughly half, kind of half the size. And I think in terms of a, you know, from a cost perspective, I think our cost structure is quite a bit lower on an A1 basis, and our performance is excellent. You know, our, you know, especially the, you know, so we manage, so the $8 billion is only the assets that are under fiduciary control of the Commissioner of Revenue. We manage roughly $50 billion in total. And so the lion's share of those are the retirement assets. And that's where we spend most, where I spend most of my time is on kind of retirement investments. And so you have a, you know, a group of 15 investment officers managing, I think the total is, you know, $47 billion kind of in total. And it's a very complex set of systems. You have, again, on the state side, there's 24 funds, something like that. There's 14 retirement funds in all their various kind of machinations. There's a, you know, defined contribution retirement system. It takes a lot of effort to make good decisions on behalf of that kind of asset base. And I think, you know, if someone were to entertain, you know, consolidating, you know, kind of all of these things, I don't expect that you would end up with cost savings. I think all of this work ultimately needs to be done. And I think that there's, you know, far less duplication kind of resources than, you know, than people might expect.
Okay, so Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we go back to slide number 4 and look at June 21, which looks like an outstanding year of 13.9% of earnings of $150 million. But when you look at what the permanent fund did that year, they had over 6% higher than that. So I'm wondering, and I don't know if you can answer that, but how much potential earnings could we have had, or did we lose because the department was anticipating the sweep?
Right.
Okay. So I'm happy to specifically answer the sweep question. I'll provide further information on that. And again, you know, over that 3-year period, it was a 2.5% return. We'll compute what that was in terms of dollars. You know, comparing, you know, whatever the June 21 returns with the permanent fund, you know, recall, kind of as we're going through this, the state couldn't own alternative investments prior to 2021. Now, alternative investment portfolios take a very long time to build. And so, you know, even had we made the decision that those alternative investments fit the liquidity profile of these state funds, we couldn't have been invested in those for, you know, for quite some time. And so
the question is the anticipation of the sweep, were decisions made that hindered the investments that we could have earned more in decisions that the Department of Revenue made as a result of being conservative in anticipation of the sweep?
Right.
So I will provide, this slide in the deck does provide those numbers in terms of percentage returns. I will provide those in terms of dollars for the impact of that. And I guess
it might. And then on that, because we've asked that question earlier, and then try to be tighten up the time frame. There is concern. Obviously, it's not directed at at the portfolio managers. It's directed at the politics being pushed into the portfolio management of the portfolio. That's the issue we're here today concerned about.
Okay.
So we want a little finer point put on the timing. And frankly, it'd be nice to know when the meetings were, that those discussions took place. Because obviously we don't want to replicate this, because this is second time that at least three of the members here at the table have dealt with incidents that we wish didn't take place. I'll go ahead and answer that, and then we're going to finish up.
So I'd certainly be happy to provide that information. And again, we'll just kind of reiterate that since I've been CIO, we do have a completely new process. It is very transparent, very independent, and I think very well vetted.
Right. I recognize that it's what the department wants to do Friday morning is to come into this finance committee and talk in detail of political winds blowing in the department. And so we understand that. We want to try to keep the politics out of the management of the funds, not only with power cost equalization, but the permanent fund and the retirement funds from also. So I do want to thank you for coming in today and helping us understand this and answering the questions, and it is appreciated. So that'll conclude the meeting today. Next meeting will be Tuesday at 9 a.m. That's Tuesday at 9 a.m. We're going to take up three pieces of legislation: Senate Bill 81, Office of Victim Rights Compensation; Senate Bill 29, Civics Education; and Senate Bill 98, Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund. We're going to talk about that bill. So with that, we will conclude today. It's at 10:28 a.m. We are adjourned.